From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talk with Salvador Mnuchin about his pioneering work in the field of family therapy. Also today, we meet filmmakers Herk Harvey and John Clifford. Their 1962 horror film, the cult movie Carnival of Souls, inspired both Rod Serling and George Romero. Now it's out on home video. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from Les Miserables Brass Band. And TV critic David Bianculli conducts a post-mortem on this past season. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Supreme Court has again made it impossible to criminally prosecute people who burn the American flag as a form of political protest. For the second time in a year, the court today left in shreds a law passed to punish flag desecration. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Last summer, after the court threw out flag-burning convictions under a Texas law, President Bush called for a constitutional amendment to outlaw flag desecration. But Congress, wary of amending the Bill of Rights for the first time in the nation's history, instead enacted a statute that it hoped would pass constitutional muster. The new law provided jail terms for anyone who mutilates or destroys a flag except to dispose of a worn-out or old flag. Today, however, the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 vote, ruled that the new law is no better than the old because the court said it punishes expressive conduct in violation of the First Amendment's guarantee to freedom of expression. Today's court ruling is certain to force a vote in Congress on a constitutional amendment. The Speaker of the House has promised a vote within 30 days and has said he will vote against it. But with an election looming this fall and public support strongly behind it, a constitutional amendment could well pass. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
The fate of Canada's constitution may be in the hands of the voters of Newfoundland. Newfoundland's premier is the only one of Canada's 10 provincial premiers who are still opposed to the Meech Lake Accord, an agreement that would grant special status to the French-speaking province of Quebec. Without that agreement, Quebec has refused to sign Canada's constitution, and some Quebec leaders have threatened to secede. Newfoundland's premier, Clyde Wells, announced today that he'll put the tentative agreement to a vote in the legislature. The accord must be ratified by June 23rd or it becomes void. Both of the men convicted in the racially charged Bensonhurst trial received heavy sentences today. Julie Cohen reports from Brooklyn.
Prosecutors in the Bensonhurst trial got just what they had asked for today. This afternoon, Joseph Fama, convicted of second-degree murder in last summer's killing of a black teenager, was sentenced to 32 and two-thirds years to life in prison. After the defendant and judge left the courtroom exploded, as it has before during this tense trial. Family and supporters of the victim let out a loud round of applause, while the family of the defendant shouted obscenities at the prosecutors. The scene was much calmer earlier today when Keith Mondello was sentenced to 5 1/3 to 16 years in jail. Mondello was the accused ringleader in the killing. Last month, a jury acquitted him of murder and manslaughter, but convicted him of lesser charges, including riot and discrimination. For National Public Radio, I'm Julie Cohen in New York.
The stock market rose today, bouncing back from four consecutive sessions of losses. Analysts attributed the gains to bargain hunting and computer-driven program buying. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 30 points to close at 2,892.57. This is NPR News. Florida Governor Bob Martinez signed a wide-ranging oil spill prevention bill today as a crippled Norwegian tanker continued to burn in the Gulf of Mexico. The Florida legislation was introduced in the wake of last year's catastrophic Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska. It increases companies' financial liability for oil spills and boosts safety and training requirements for ships and oil terminals. Martinez also noted the ongoing struggle to contain the fire on board the Norwegian supertanker Mega Borg, southeast of Galveston, Texas. The ship, reported in danger of sinking, has 38 million gallons of oil on board. The possibility of another major oil spill, this one off Cape Cod, appears to have diminished. Salvage efforts on a passenger ship that ran aground near Cape Cod Canal have been hindered by bad weather. Peter Thompson of member station WBUR has this report.
The 617-foot Bermuda Star has a 90-foot-long gash in its hull, exposing four fuel tanks to the open seas. However, Coast Guard and cleanup officials say seawater pushing up into the tanks should prevent any further oil from leaking out before the hole can be patched. About 7,500 gallons of number 6 fuel oil spilled out when the vessel, en route from New York City to Canada, ran aground in dense fog yesterday morning. Officials say about 1,000 gallons has washed up on a nearby island, and the rest appears to have dissipated. Improving weather is expected to allow cleanup and repair crews to begin their work tomorrow morning. Results of drug and alcohol tests administered to the ship's operators shortly after the grounding have not yet been released. For National Public Radio, this is Peter Thompson reporting.
Spokespeople for the breakaway Baltic Republic say that Soviet President Gorbachev has agreed to meet with their presidents to discuss the campaigns for independence. The meeting, set for tomorrow, could mark the first time the Soviet president has held joint talks with the presidents of Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dr. Salvador Mnuchin is one of the founders of family therapy. His specialty is working with troubled adolescents. Mnuchin started practicing family therapy in the 1950s when he worked at a reform school for delinquent boys. By the 1970s, he had become known for his aggressive style, which provoked family members into confrontations that dramatized their problems. Mnuchin says he's toned down his approach as he's gotten older, but his focus has widened. He now views families in their political and social context, and when necessary, he's spoken out for reform in the juvenile justice, mental health, and welfare systems. During his career, Mnuchin has worked with both poor and middle-class families. Salvador Mnuchin grew up in Argentina, the son of Russian Jewish immigrants. He emigrated to Israel in the 1940s, then moved to the U.S. He's semi-retired now and lives in New York, where he's the director of Family Studies, Inc., and a professor of research in psychiatry at NYU. I spoke with Dr. Mnuchin in March when his latest book, Institutionalizing Madness, had just come out. I asked him why it's important to see the whole family instead of treating an individual alone.
When we see the total family, we don't see only Oedipus. But we see Oedipus father, we see Oedipus mother. We don't see the relationship between the child and the mother, but we see in what way the relationship between the child and the mother is organized by the distance between the father and the mother and things of that sort. So it is just common sense. It is something that my grandparents knew. It is something that religious people know, that they work with families because they are a unit.
One of the things that you've become known for is pioneering almost confrontational techniques in your therapy with families. Can you give us an example of a confrontation like that you've tried that you think is effective?
I started working in the 60s with families in Harlem. I was a psychiatrist at Wiltwick School for Delinquent Children. And I was working with families of the slums. And in these families, what we were noticing is sometimes the kind of affect would go from lack of response to a large intensity of response. Middle ranges were difficult to elicit. And so frequently I found myself that I needed to introduce, to provoke, to lend affect, to create, to break apathy, to break the lack of energy in families that had been depowered by social systems that intrude on them. And so I developed a technique of creating unbalance, of creating stress, of putting people vis-a-vis each other and asking them to talk in ways that they didn't talk. So that I developed a rep that I was confrontational, mostly because people in the field tend to to be kind of bland. You know, the idea of challenging. I would not say that I was confrontational. What I was is challenging. I am still challenging. I think that the way in which families, family members deal with each other become routine, and there are rules that constrain novelty. And so these rules need to be challenged. And so I would challenge.
Well, let's see if I can get an example. For instance, I've read about how sometimes working with anorectic families, with a family in which a teenager had stopped eating, you'd say to the parents, force your child to eat.
And in situations like that, what I used to do is to create conflicts between parents and children as a way of moving the anorectic person away from her concentration in the obsessive relationship with food and more toward a me-you kind of relationship that that I felt was necessary for her, because usually it is a woman, for her to begin to be involved. I was breaking the patterns of functioning. So I did say to parents, don't talk with her. She needs to eat. You need to save her. You will not let her die. These were very seriously ill patients. And it is your function that she should eat. That was a confrontational technique that was related to the idea of empowering parents, of saying to parents that they have hopes and that they have a function in the healing. Now, that is something that is generic to family therapy. The idea that the family members have a function in the healing of people, and that and the introduction of hope. Families come to you, you see, with a sense of depletion. They had worked for hours, months, year in problems that are insoluble. And in the end, when they come to you, kind of they are like a caricature of themselves. They are narrow. They are narrow in the sense that they believe that there is only one way of doing things. And one of the things that the family therapist does in a variety of ways, sometimes confrontational, sometimes being friendly, sometimes being seductive, sometimes all kind of ways, sometimes being cognitive, teaching, and so on. But what you try is to elicit options, to expand the way in which the family members see themselves. In effect, what you are doing is expanding their history. You see, families come, family members share a history, a story. And the family therapist said, I will help you to construct a story about your life that is more complex than the story that you tell each other.
Now, let me ask you, say you were doing one-on-one psychiatry, and your client was the daughter, you know, the young woman who had stopped eating, and you were trying to deal with this problem. Do you think you wouldn't have been able to get at how manipulative she was of the family? Do you think that the psychiatrist always takes the side and empathizes with the client and doesn't necessarily see ways that they're abusing other people?
The story that the patient tells is the story that the therapist works with. The story that the family therapist experience and sees is much more complex than the story that the individual therapist experience, because you begin to see the same story from a different perspective. It is, you see how the story of the daughter and the story that the mother has and the story that the father has respond in certain ways to the same kind of roots, and nonetheless are in a way modifying each other, interfering, supporting. One of the things that family therapists think is that while one member is expressing a symptom, the rest of the family, in some way or other, is involved supporting that symptom, organizing that symptom, modifying the symptom, that the family functions very much in ways that that all the family members are suffering because there is one symptomatic patient. And one therapist, Carl Whitaker, a family therapist, says that he uses the metaphor of the knight in the chess game, and he says there is the black knight that is the one that carries the symptom, the symptomatic member, that is constrained, but the white knight is equally constrained in its movements, though it's not labeled, so that in some way he equates all family members as being restricted.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about your approach to family therapy. And my guest is Salvador Mnuchin, and he's a pioneer in the field of family therapy. He's the director of Family Studies Incorporated in New York, a professor of psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania, and a professor of research in psychiatry at NYU. He's the author of several books. His new book is called Institutionalizing Madness. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Salvador Mnuchin, a pioneer in the field of family therapy. Do you think understanding behavior, understanding a problem, helps you change it?
No. I know that this is, the answer should have been yes, but I don't think so. If that would be so, we would just need to read books.
That's right.
You know, and then we will all be very wise. No, and actually I think very few people in the field think that understanding a problem changes it. You know, we are very much constrained by an experience that is much more complex than just understanding or lack of understanding of a phenomenon.
Then what does change behavior?
Relationships. Let me say, for instance, you have an... I am interviewing a couple.
Mm-hmm.
And the man says certain things. And he says, well, because you know, blah, 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 blah. That kind of tone of voice. And he... And you see the wife being afraid. She makes gestures of becoming smaller and smaller. Now, at the same time, but she doesn't say anything. Well, in situations like that, the man thinks that what he said is the content of what he said. But what I hear is that the woman's response, it's not to the content, but to the manner in which he said that. And then one can challenge the man. One can ask him, do you know what you had done recently? Do you know why she doesn't answer? Well, she's always withholding. She's always not responding to me. Do you know that you do not allow people to answer to you? That kind of direct observation of phenomena that people do not know. Or, for instance, you can say to the wife, you need to answer. And you put them in a situation that they usually don't have. Because the usual situation is, he says, and she escapes. Then he goes after her. She escapes. And that is the transaction. Now, you do not allow that to happen. And you do not intervene. You just intervene by saying, please, talk with him. And then something completely new occurs. Something that does not occur in the usual transactions in the family. So that what you are beginning to work is with what I used to call the structure of the family. Issues of proximity, issues of distance, the ways in which in families people enter into coalitions against other members, things of that sort. You begin to change the way in which people relate with each other.
In your new book, Institutionalizing Madness, you write that therapy that focuses on the family in isolation is in danger of serving an ideology that values families but resists taking political measures and resists dealing with social factors that overtax families. In other words, that if you're just looking at a family and you're not looking at other political and economic and social factors that are making family life hard, you're not really looking at the full picture.
That's correct. I think that in 1964, I think, or something like that, we wrote a book called Families of the Slums. When I read this book now, for instance, I am impressed that this book was considered a pioneering book in family therapy, was an extremely naive book from a political point of view. Because at no point did we challenge the judicial system, for instance, the way in which the judicial system impacted in the life of these families. We were working with welfare families, and at no point did we challenge the way in which the welfare system depowers these families, the way in which the social institutions that work with the poor create a situation that maintains these people in a depowered position.
You've worked with both middle-class families and with poor families. What are some of the basic differences, if there are any, in the types of techniques you would use to approach both?
Well, there is one basic difference, and it is that the poor family, if we continue with the metaphor of the story of poor families is written not by themselves. The story of poor families is written by social institutions that intrude on the families, creating a sense of lack of control over their own destiny. Middle-class families have the illusion, but in effect that's true, that they have the way of controlling their destiny, much more certainly than the poor family. So that when you work with poor families, you really need to work at ways of empowering. The position then of the therapist is, it's a difficult one because one needs to help in such a way that doesn't depower. Now that's not a problem when you're working with middle-class families. You can challenge without thinking that you are depowering or destroying. With poor families, the main emphasis is in eliciting their strength. And they have a lot of strength.
Dr. Salvador Mnuchin is my guest, and he's a pioneer in the field of family therapy. He's the author of many books, including the new book, Institutionalizing Madness. If you don't mind, I'd like to ask you a question that I'm sure is quite unanswerable, but I'll ask it anyways. Why is it that so many families are so neurotic? I mean, you know, most people believe that the family unit is the best option that people have, and yet so many families fall apart, and even in so many families that stay together, there are these terribly self-destructive, neurotic relationships that go on. I mean, it seems to almost be typical as opposed to atypical.
Well, you see, I don't see it that way. I see families are very, very, very complex social organisms. And in general, you know, people live the best way that they can. And when I see families, I see them not as neurotic, but as families that sometimes get stuck in a process of evolvement. Families that were working okay up to a point, but then a change occurs in their life. A child goes to college, somebody gets sick. And so then they continue working with the old patterns instead of changing when circumstances change. So that the function of the therapist is help them to become a more complex organism. You know, I think that your question is related to a misunderstanding of what families are. You know, there is not such a thing as the family without conflict. That means that's not the nature of the animal. The nature of the animal is that two people that come from different families at some point join together and they need to learn to create a new culture, in which their own children will grow up and become adults. And this is a very complex phenomenon, and people need to accommodate, need to share, need to accept the other people's point of view. It's tremendously complex. I think it's less boring that way. So I don't call that neurotic. You know, I think that forever and ever, the families will be rather imperfect social organisms. And there is nothing wrong with it. That's what we have.
Do you think that you've been able to use your expertise as a family therapist in your life as a father?
You should ask that question to my children. They are the only ones that can answer that.
Well, I figure there's almost a danger, I figure, in being the family expert in your family.
No, because you can't. You can't be an expert in your own family. You really, in your own family, you are the same kind of bumbling, fumbling father that other people's are.
Okay. Dr. Mnuchin, thank you so much.
Fine. Thank you.
Salvador Mnuchin is the director of Family Studies Incorporated and a professor of research in psychiatry at NYU. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, songwriter and singer John Hiatt. He has a new album called Stolen Moments. Hiatt wrote the song Thing Called Love, which was a hit for Bonnie Raitt last year. Don't have to humble yourself to me. I ain't your judge or your king. Baby, you know you ain't no Queen of Sheba.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. That's music from Mexico, performed by Les Miserables Brass Band. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from this group that combines brass instrumentation with eclectic global tastes. Also, we meet the writer and director of a cult classic. Carnival of Souls is a low-budget horror film made in 1962 that was re-released to theaters last summer and just came out on home video. And with TV firmly entrenched in reruns till the fall, TV critic David Bianculli reviews the highs and lows of this past season. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Former National Security Advisor John Poindexter has been sentenced to 6 months in jail for his role in the Iran-Contra scandal. Federal Court Judge Harold Green sentenced Poindexter to 6 months in prison on each of five felony counts, but allowed these sentences to run concurrently. The former Navy Admiral had been convicted of lying to Congress. The embattled president of Liberia, Samuel Doe, says that he hopes the United States will intervene and end the bloody six-month-long civil war in his country. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
President Doe's government has been under attack since December from rebel forces commanded by Charles Taylor. Taylor is a former government official who had been accused of embezzlement before he fled to the United States in 1983. President Doe told the cable news network today that for the past 6 months he has been asking the United States to come to his rescue. The Bush administration has not publicly acknowledged that appeal, although U.S. warships carrying 1,500 troops sit offshore Liberia. Doe also told CNN that he refused to negotiate with Taylor, whom he called a criminal. Nevertheless, the two sides have accepted the mediation of church groups for talks later this week that will be held at the U.S. Embassy in Monrovia. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Also in Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled today that the federal government can order National Guard troops to take part in peacetime training overseas, even over the objections of a governor. This ruling was met by some disappointment in the state of Minnesota, where the case began. Tom Bonsi of member station WCAL reports.
Minnesota Governor Rudy Perpich challenged the federal government's peacetime control over the National Guard after local troops were sent on training missions to Central America. Reaction to the ruling came from Minnesota Attorney General Hubert Humphrey III, who says he's disappointed by the decision.
We did win a few battles on the way up, and I think it was an important issue that had to be addressed. If you don't try to win these things, you never get those issues resolved, and you don't have an opportunity for an opinion before the court.
Humphrey says today's ruling was valuable in that it cleared up what had been an ambiguous relationship between the states and the federal government over the National Guard. He says now that the law has been set, the state will obey it. For National Public Radio, I'm Tom Bonsi in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And by a vote of 5-4, the U.S. Supreme Court has effectively invalidated a law that makes it a crime to burn the American flag. The High Court held that the federal law violates free speech protections for political dissent and expression. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 30 points to close at 2,892.57 on volume of some 120 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 3-2. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Trumpeter Frank London founded Les Miserables Brass Band in 1980 with some musicians he knew in the Boston area. The members' work experience hints at the band's diverse repertoire. Tubist Marcus Rojas has played with jazz composer Henry Threadgill and the New York City Ballet. Frank London and trombonist David Harris have worked in klezmer bands. French hornist Marshall Seeley has played with the Guadalajara Philharmonic. In 1986, the band supplied the music for David Byrne and Robert Wilson's stage production, The Knee Plays. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says he likes Les Miserables' creative unpredictability.
Brass bands exist all over the world, from South America to Central Asia. from West Africa to Eastern Europe. One reason is that military bands have spread brass instruments all over the place, and those horns are built to keep working, even if they get banged around. Les Miserables Brass Band, which is six brass, a reed player, and a drummer, are dedicated to playing all the world's brass music. Their new album, Manic Traditions, from Northeastern Records, includes music from Mexico, Serbia, and Pakistan, and three marches from Bolivia. Les Miserables also play a few originals and some music that wasn't written for brass, like Manic Depression by Jimi Hendrix. It was arranged by tuba player Marcus Rojas. Playing something like that, Les Miserables show how adaptable brass bands are. In this country, brass bands are one of the foundations on which jazz was built. Just after the Civil War, and maybe even earlier than that, black bands started to appear in the rural South playing hymns and secular music. In 1954, folklorist Frederick Ramsey found a few such bands still playing. The field recordings he made came out on a wonderful old record for folkways called Country Brass Bands. It gives us a good idea of what one kind of music jazz evolved from sounded like. Les Miserables play a version of one hymn from that album, Precious Lord, Hold My Hand. I want to play a little of the original first so you can compare the two. This is the Laneville Johnson Union Brass Band, recorded in 1954 near New Bern, Alabama. Les Miserables' version is slower and not nearly so out of tune, but they get its spirit just right. Les Miserables Brass Band's repertoire is so eclectic, you may not always be sure what you're listening to. On their version of a folk tune from Pakistan, Matt Dario's clarinet sounds lifted from a Jewish klezmer band. The first time I listened to Les Miserables' album, I didn't have the list of tunes in front of me. When one cut came on, I assumed it had been written by an American minimalist composer. ¶¶ Actually, the band discovered the tune Nyoro on a collection of African music, a reminder of just how much minimalism owes to Africa. Les Miserables demonstrate how easily one style can slide into another. That's a good thing, because it was through fusions of different musical cultures that stuff like jazz and rock and roll got started in the first place.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. Les Miserables Brass Band's new album, Manic Traditions, is on the Northeastern Popular Arts label. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. This is the story of a horror film which, like its main character, has come back from the dead. The low-budget Carnival of Souls went completely unnoticed when it was released in 1962. It played in so few theaters, hardly anyone got to see it. But now it's back in distribution, getting some very good reviews. Terence Rafferty in The New Yorker called it bleak, unnerving. You're immersed in it, and when you come up, the world looks stranger. My guests are John Clifford, the writer, and Herc Harvey, the director of the film. They worked together for decades in an educational film company called Centron in Lawrence, Kansas. Carnival of Souls is their only feature film. It's the story of a church organist who's killed in a car that drives off a bridge into the river. Somehow she mysteriously walks out of the river and resumes her life. But she's trapped in a world between life and death. A phantom is following her to take her back to the world of the dead where she belongs. The phantom eventually possesses her and her music.
Profane! Sacrilege! What are you playing in this church? Have you no respect? Do you feel no reverence? And I feel sorry for you and your lack of soul. This organ, the music of this church, these things have meaning and significance to us. I assume they did to you. But without this awareness, I'm afraid you cannot be our organist.
I spoke with Clifford and Harvey last summer when Carnival of Souls was first re-released to theaters. We've brought the interview back from the dead because Carnival of Souls has been given new life again. It's out on home video. It's also continuing to open in theaters around the country. The inspiration for Carnival of Souls was an abandoned amusement park on the outskirts of Salt Lake City that Herc Harvey found on a drive back from the West Coast.
It was one of the weirdest places I ever saw. And I stopped the car, looked at it for a minute, and thought, I got to get closer to this. So I walked down this long causeway out into the salt area, and there was this old deserted amusement park. And I came back and told John, I said, you know, this is a terrific location. I think we can use some of the local locations and locations there and make a good feature film. John then fleshed out the ideas that we used.
This is a film that's really about complete alienation, about being incapable of making contact with other people, or as one character puts it, living in isolation from the human race. Were either of you experiencing that kind of alienation when you made this movie? Do I hear a laugh?
Yes, you do. No, I don't think so at all. No.
I don't believe so. No, it was... No, it wasn't.
Well, you sure did a compelling job, though, of expressing that kind of emotion. It must have come from somewhere.
Partly it was a creative decision to keep this woman away from all sympathy and help and to share the idea of being totally stranded and facing something that you can't explain.
I want to ask you about a couple of the images from the film that really stand out in my memory. One is, this is toward the end, in this abandoned dance pavilion, there's all of the lost souls, all of the ghoul-like people are dancing around, but there is no music. It's a very eerie, wonderful image. Herc Harvey, can you talk about creating the look of that?
Well, this was one of the reasons I think we decided to do the film in that location, because I had seen that location, and I think that's one of the weirdest locations. And actually, I think the idea of the dance and all was just fit to the location.
Another scene. The main character, the woman who's living in between life and death, she's in a dressing room trying on a dress in a department store. And she comes out and she realizes that for the moment she's become invisible. No one can either hear nor see her. It's a very, also a very eerie moment in which she's temporarily tuned out of life.
It was more than just not being able to hear anything or make contact with anyone. It was as though for a time I didn't exist. As though I had no place in the world. No part of the life around me.
I remember in the first draft that scene wasn't in there. We were talking one day about in the middle of the film needed something, and I can't remember which one of us suggested it, but I remember in our conversation we came out with this idea of suspending her, of having her disappear for a while from life and then go back and forth in that way. I remember sitting in the apartment thinking of that idea, but I can't remember exactly how it came up.
Kirk Harvey, you cast yourself as the phantom who keeps following this woman who's living between life and death, following her to finally bring her back to the world of the dead where she belongs, because she was actually killed in this car crash. Tell me why you cast yourself in that role.
That's my purpose in life. No, strictly economics.
Uh-huh. Well, you could have cast yourself in
a little bit of ham. A little bit of ham.
A little bit of ham, yes. Sure, you know, if you're going to do it, you might as well go all out and do it, right. No, part of it was the fact that I knew I was going to take three actors to Salt Lake, Mary Henry, the doctor, and the minister. And that was it budget-wise, and so, you know, it was just much easier on location rather than having somebody come in on the spur of the moment and do it, to go ahead and cast yourself and do it. Although, I always wanted to play a monster, really. I mean, that's, you know, acting. I majored in acting in college, and I enjoy it.
The main character in this movie is a church organist, and she plays some pretty bizarre music through the course of the movie. I think the organ is a really perfect touch, since organs have been used as a musical accompaniment for some horror films. And also playing church organ, I mean, after all, that is the place of the soul, you know, in a religious, in a house of religion. Tell me about making the organ such an important part of the film.
This may sound a little prosaic after what you just said, but there happens to be an organ factory in Lawrence, Kansas, and I knew they had this magnificent room where they test the organs. And I was thinking of ways that we could use whatever facilities we could find to put production values in the show. And I thought there ought to be some way I could use that organ factory. And then I thought, well, make the girl an organist. And everything else kind of fell in line from that idea.
Now, George Romero has said that Carnival of Souls was one of the inspirations behind his Night of the Living Dead. Who were some of the inspirations for you, Herc Harvey, in terms of making a cheap, independent horror film?
Well, at that time, there were a lot of people that were doing this, and probably Bob Altman over in Kansas City had just finished making about four films for Elmer Roden, who at that time owned Commonwealth Theaters in Kansas City, and they had gotten together and made Juvenile the Delinquents. They made about four films, and not the horror variety. Most of them were either cops and robbers or like the Delinquents at that time. This was the 60s, and that was a topic that was favorable. And we just saw them doing it and thought that the horror genre would be pretty good to get into as far as making enough money back to make another film.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did
which was really the reason we made it.
Oh, so you used this as a movie to make another movie?
Sure.
Yeah, which you never did. This is the great mystery. It's really, I think, such a wonderful and intriguing movie, and you never made another theatrical feature again.
That's true.
Well, you see, the best laid plans of mice and men all go to hell when a distributor steals all the money.
Is that what happened?
That's what happened.
Mm-hmm. So tell me what happened with this distributor.
Well, this was Hertz Lion Corporation in Los Angeles, and they were Their names were given to us by General Labs at that time, and it was a very straightforward presentation because it was a stock-held company, and they said it had just been formed, and Mr. Ken Hertz at that time was the president. And basically, he took our film and six from Texas. Then he bought several films from England and started a distribution company and was doing fine. We got early reports that it was doing all right. It only showed, basically, as a double feature in southeastern United States, mainly in drive-ins. And after a while, he owed us so much money, and I got back from a trip, well, just before I went on a trip to South America, he sent me a check. It bounced, and I knew we were in trouble. The next thing I know, he's out of the country, and I'm in South America, and it's hard to communicate as to what to do. We tried to trace him, and that was it. The money was gone.
I have to ask, you said earlier that the alienation that's expressed in this movie isn't something that you were both personally feeling. But I can't help but wonder if you maybe felt more alienated than you're letting on after this movie came out while you were working at the Educational Film Company, because it seems that you're both, I don't know, that you both have spirits that are a little bit odd, a little offbeat, and that you might have felt just a little too offbeat for where you were working.
Well, that's probably something to that. Maybe we leave it buried. we have scripts today. We're ready to go on movies right now if anybody wants to come up with the money.
Well, are you hoping that that's going to be a result of the revival of Carnival of Souls?
My own feeling is that I can take it or leave it. Because one of the nice things that happens is this is all a bonus as far as I'm concerned, because I have had a very good career, proud of the films I've made. And some of them, that is. But basically, it was great. I got to travel all around the world and do things, meet a lot of interesting people, so I don't know what more I would want. Except, you do think, well, okay, one feature film, that doesn't say much. Ought to do it some more.
Herc Harvey, John Clifford, thank you both very much.
Terry, well, the fact that you saw our film twice makes us love you dearly.
That's right.
And thank you for calling us.
Director Herc Harvey and writer John Clifford, their 1962 movie Carnival of Souls is now on home video. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Well, Robert, you have several sentences to cover today.
Yes, as in finish this sentence, John Poindexter. He was sentenced to 6 months in jail for his role in the Iran-Contra affair. Also, maximum sentences for the two young men involved in the Bensonhurst racial killing, Joseph Fama and Keith Mondello. Both got prison terms. We'll also have news about a California program to build mini hospitals. It's a form of rural hospital which is being introduced to substitute for the far more costly general hospitals. And from the Middle East, news of Israel's new hardline government and why many people are concerned about the possibility of an all-out war between Israel and the Arabs.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The 1989-90 television season is over. The May rating sweeps have been swept under the rug, and the networks have begun looking ahead to the 1990 fall season. As the networks look ahead, TV critic David Bianculli looks back, saluting the best and worst of the year in television.
The last few years, the most exciting and wonderful TV shows have been miniseries. The Singing Detective in 1988, Lonesome Dove in 1989. Not this season. It's been a really lousy year for miniseries and made-for-TV movies. There were a couple of good ones, but not a single one that stands out as terrific. That's the bad news. The good news is that my perennial picks for the season's best weekly series, Wise Guy for drama, The Wonder Years, and The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd for comedy, have been displaced by two even better new shows that have lots of people talking about TV again. Here comes the drum roll. The best comedy series of the season is It's not great because it's a primetime cartoon. It's great because the actors on The Simpsons do better work without bodies than most sitcom actors do with them. Bart Simpson is TV's biggest breakout character since The Fonz, and the show's writing is funnier than anything else on the tube. My favorite part comes early, when Bart writes different punishment phrases on the blackboard each week during the opening credits. So far, he's written such things as, I will not burp in class, they are laughing at me, not with me, and my favorite, I will not waste chalk. Now for drama. It's a show that has as many hidden jokes as St. Elsewhere, the best TV soundtrack ever, and the wildest plots and performances around. Dollars to Donuts, with the emphasis on the donuts, it's the best drama series on the air, and the most fun. And the winner is...
Diane, 11:30 a.m., February 24th. Entering the town of Twin Peaks, 5 miles south of the Canadian border, 12 miles west of the state line. I've never seen so many trees in my life. As W.C. Fields would say, I'd rather be here than Philadelphia.
David Letterman still gets Best Talk Show honors, and Nightline gets the award for Best News Show, and that's about it for the top honors. As for the bottom honors, the worst shows of the year, give a grand slam to the drama series Grand Slam, but save the bottom of the barrel for the weekly series, you guessed it, The Bradys. I'm already looking forward to next season. Twin Peaks will solve the Laura Palmer murder, The Simpsons will show something besides reruns, and, best of all, I won't have The Bradys to kick around anymore.
David Bianculli is television critic for The New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Thad Kirk. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Don't let yourself be hurt this time.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
John Hyatt's song, Thing Called Love, helped revive Bonnie Raitt's career. On the next Fresh Air, Hyatt talks about the songs he's written for himself and others. Also, Dave Thomas talks with us about SCTV and his current network comedy show. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.